You're listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast, a product of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Association. To learn more, visit our website at or.nhsbca.org. Welcome to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. I'm Derek Duman, OBCA President and Boys Basketball Coach at West Albany High School. Today, I'm joined by Wes Pappas, Girls Basketball Coach at Tualatin High School. Coach, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks, Coach Duman. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. We appreciate it. I want to start, Coach, for those that might not be familiar with you. Can you give us a little bit of your background in hoops, how you started and how you got into coaching and how you ended up as the head girls coach at Tualatin?
Well, basketball has been part of my life as long as I can remember. This year will be my 20th year in coaching. My first, I guess, time I really was inspired. I don't think I got really inspired by my coaches growing up. But that was, and I look back at that was because I was an idiot, really. But so the first time I really got inspired by a coach was when I started coaching, and I coached under Greg Evers, who's now the boys coach at Forest Grove. He was the girls coach at Forest Grove. And he got me the freshman girls job there, like 2002. And, I was one of those things where I could take the ninth grade girls or the eighth grade boys. And I can't even remember why I chose the girls. I think they asked me first, and it was high school. And so I went and did the girls side of things. And, it was just great. I remember just, for the first time really soaking in everything. I really wanted to watch Evers' practices, and so I would coach the freshman team, and that was great. But I just would just kind of speed over to the other gym and try to catch as much of the varsity practice as I could. And just the way he ran the program and everything, kind of really inspired me. Later on, I ended up linking up with Steve Naylor for 1 year at Century, and then we went to Tiger together for 7 years. I was his assistant, varsity assistant there. And he, both Coach Evers and Coach Naylor taught me a ton. I think one of the most important things is you've got to be an assistant coach. It doesn't matter, how much you play, you got to learn how to coach. It's a completely different thing. And coaching under guys that are really good or women that are really good, it can be such an educational experience. And that's when I really started getting going. After 7 years at Tigard, I went over to Sherwood. I coached that program for 6 years by myself or as the head coach. And then 2 years at Tualatin now. And it's been great. I've loved every step of the way. This is, like I said, this will be my 20th year of high school girls this coming up season.
Yeah. I love talking to coaches, kind of like you were saying, being assistant, learning the ropes, and then making that jump. You make that jump, and even it seems like no matter how prepared you are as an assistant, it still kind of smacks you in the face a little bit, right, when you first become a head coach. I'm curious, what was kind of that like, as an experienced assistant? You got your own head coaching job. What was that transition like? Was there anything where you're like, oh gosh, I'm the head coach now? this is the big time.
I think it would be really big in a lot of areas. For me, it was just a couple, because the coaching aspect of it, Steve Naylor, still one of my best friends to this day. He has this amazing ability to kind of make every kind of situation work. He's just amazing. I learned so much about, how to deal with the kids from him. But in terms of like the X's and O's and stuff, I was already getting my way with, a lot of that stuff and running the defense and all those kind of things. So that part wasn't any kind of adjustment for me. I just continued doing all the same stuff. But where the adjustment was is it's all the behind the scenes stuff, right? It's the fundraising. It's the dealing with the parents and having to be that kind of last line there. And so those kind of things, it's a big job, when you get we kind of become these like small businesses where you have to fundraise so much, these days to make a program work. that it's, you know, it's not just the coaching. You know, it's all the other stuff that I think kind of really smacks you in the face when you're the, you know, the person in charge.
For sure. For sure. I want to talk about the last season that we had this past spring. Obviously unusual for many reasons, played through a pandemic, masks and everything. As coaches, we had to adapt and adjust probably a lot of what we did in a typical year to kind of fit our short season. I'm curious, what are some of the key takeaways you take from this past season and maybe adjustments that you used?
I'll look back, and my key takeaway is I'm just so glad it happened. You know, I think I probably took a year or two off my life just stressing about, I had this amazing group of high school seniors it's five kids that, you know, it's just the best senior class I've ever had. In terms of just, you know, I mean, the good players, you know, no doubt about it, but just their love of the game. And really, I think how much they appreciated every athlete, they appreciated each other. You know, they appreciated, you know, the coaches, they appreciated every element of it, and that made it so fun. And the thought of them not getting their senior year really sent me into high gear. So, I mean, I did so much behind the scenes. I was writing letters. I was blowing up the governor's office, you know, stuff. I was joining Coach Lever, the football coach at Tualatin, and his West Coast Coaching Alliance thing. I was doing stuff with him. We even went on Canzano's radio show and lobbied for a season. You know, I just had to put my full effort into trying to get them to play. And, you know, I wish we were like other states and we would have got the full length of the season and official championship and everything. But the fact that we got, you know, what we got was fantastic. The seniors got sent off in style. We ended up making the semifinals of the, you know, the playoff that Jeff Peeler PIL athletic director, assistant athletic director, put together. I want to thank him. That was so huge. What Jeff Peeler did putting that thing together, which was ultimately on the girls' side, was a real championship. I mean, it was the teams that should have been in it. And, you know, we at the beginning of the season, I said the three best teams in the state were us, West Lynn, and South Medford. And we were three of the final four, and South Medford was the best team, and they won it. And, you know, that was what he did was amazing too. So I think my takeaway, you know, we had to make adjustments and all those things. The fact that it happened was great. And the amount of people that put work into making it happen, I will always remember.
Yeah, for sure. And you talk about, you know, really talented, great group of girls that love the game. You know, in some ways this season, you're going to kind of be, I don't want to say starting over because you've got good young talent coming, but probably how you're approaching this season is a little bit different, I would assume, from a coaching standpoint. How is how you're approaching this season maybe different than it would have been had we had a regular year last year?
You know, for us, we're very specific in what we do offensively and defensively. I think we always gain on people during the summer. The thing we had going for us last year without having a summer, you know, going into last year, that hurt us. There's no doubt about it. Without having team camp, you know, that we always do, which is just so huge for us. There's, you know, as much as we, you know, we're successful and we're this close to making the championship game this year and all that kind of stuff and won our league, we still didn't actually execute very well. You know, we had good players. So that definitely hurt us not having a summer. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And then this year was basically no summer again, right? Because, you know, by the time our season was over this season, then it was club ball time. And we lost the five seniors. And then our best player really kind of returning already, you know, has got a knee injury. And she's going to be out for this next season. So basically we're going to be fielding the team that's, you know, 90% never been really on varsity floor before. So, and then with no summer. So, I mean, it's just going to be, you know, the fundamentals. Back to the fundamentals. You know, obviously I'm a big zone guy. I think people know that. Like our kids right now don't even know how to play a zone. You know, they're that. You know, they have that. if you're a sophomore in high school right now or going to be a junior or you're going to be a sophomore, let's say, you haven't had a summer yet in high school. Mm-hmm. in our system, and you've had one shortened season. You know, I mean, like, I mean, that's that, and that might have been on JV. You know, so, and that's what we're kind of putting into the game. So it's, you know, we're going to be playing catch up all year, but then, you know, a lot of teams are going to be in that same position.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, 20 years of coaching, the last probably, I don't know, what it would be, 12, 13 years as a head coach. I'm curious how maybe your style or philosophy has changed from how you started to where you're at now.
You know, that's such a great question. You grow so much, but I think, like, core value wise, I'm exactly the same as where I started. You know, I started off as a man-to-man coach, because that's what Evers and Coach Naylor wanted. And that obviously switched over time. But how I motivate, how I truly, really care about the kids I coach, and how just excited, I get when I see improvement is all really the same. I will say that, I mean, you definitely get better, because, you know, there's just no way, I don't care who you are, there's no way that in year 1, 2, 3, 4, you are going to be anywhere close to where you are in year 15 or year 20, you know, because you're just constantly getting better. But as long as you're coaching and being true to yourself, I think coaching to your personality and your beliefs, you know, I think those core things would, you know, probably stay the same. And they have for me, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. My follow-up question was, what would you tell your younger self? You know, year one, Coach Pappas at Sherwood High School. What advice would you give him?
Figure out the zone and start running that earlier. I don't know. I mean, just, you just got to go through it. You're just, I mean, listen and try to learn from people. You know, I did that, but I could always do that more. You know, and just be patient, do the best you can, and know that there is no royal road to this. You've got to go through the struggles. You got to figure things out. You're dealing with people. You learn as you go. Just enjoy the ride. You know, I mean, it's 20 years and it's just gone so quickly. You gotta, you know, sometimes you sit there and go, ooh, we're going to be good in 2 years because I got this class coming up, or we were good last, you know. It's like, you know, you just got to enjoy every year. You don't know how many of these you got, you know. And with one season almost like ripped away from us, you really don't know how many you got, you know, kind of thing. So enjoy every moment of it.
What do you hope players will be able to know or do after playing 4 years for you? And how do you know that they've met kind of those standards or core values?
I think the big thing for me, I think this would be girls or boys, but I'm on the girls' side, and it's, I want my girls to leave with this kind of true confidence that they can just take on the world. And I think there's kind of a, hey, good job type of, you can try to prop somebody up, but they've got to actually experience real success to gain the kind of true confidence that I'm talking about. And I always try to really let my players know that they're really rock stars. I mean, there's very few people that would put themselves out there. You know, basketball, you're on display. Those five varsity kids that are on the floor at any given time, I mean, everybody can see. You can kind of hide on a football field a little bit, you know, certain positions. You can kind of hide on the soccer field a little bit. Basketball is just like everybody sees exactly what's going on. The fact that they put themselves out there, especially those doubleheader nights we have with the boys where you get the big crowds and it's just the gym, like, they are out there. They're superstars. And the fact that they – and it's hard. Basketball's hard, you know.
Yeah.
And the fact that they go out there and are just such, you know, rock stars out there, I really want them to – be able to apply that and kind of look back at that and go, you know what, no matter what situation I'm at, you know, whether it be professionally or whatever, I'm going to be able to look back and go, you know, I was a stud out there, and I pushed through things that I thought that I couldn't, and I can then apply this to, you know, future unforeseen circumstances. you know, just confidence in themselves. And, you know, you stay in touch with these kids as they go. And, you know, I don't know exactly when you know that they've got it. But it's sure a beautiful thing when they do.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, I got to coach girls, for a couple of years, and I feel like those are some of the best relationships I still have, you know, because when you do instill that confidence, and girls that are graduating college now that are sending me thank you notes or getting married,
and
you guys do that
yeah.
too, you know, but I feel like it's, I don't know, the girls I got to coach, I felt the same way, you know what I mean? Like they left feeling valued and confident in themselves, and it's a huge part of girls and guys, obviously.
Fantastic.
But girls tend to be a little more thankful.
I remember you on the girls' side down at camp at Thurston, right?
Yep, down at Thurston. Exactly. Yep. So, yeah. All right, so the question every coach loves talking about, parents. Coach, I know you've had a chance to deal with parents, that we all do. But something I feel like as coaches, we're always trying to develop. How are ways that I can engage parents better? How can I deal with these situations better? So I'm kind of curious, what kind of your general philosophy of dealing with parents in your program, and what are some things that maybe have worked and maybe some that haven't?
So I try not to be too preachy about telling people how to work with parents, because every time you think you have it down, you're gonna be, you know, blindsided by a level of, you know, wacky that you have never encountered before. Honestly, politics, the most extreme right or most extreme left, you know, I'm not saying one side or the other. So the wackiest stuff that comes out of Washington, D.C. on either side, when everybody's like, oh my gosh, can you believe this happened? My friend's on the right, my friend's on the left. I honestly tell them, like, that doesn't even seem strange to me. I've coached girls basketball for 20 years and dealt with parents. You know, it's like, now given, the majority of them are great, and there's been many a parent that I've said, how do you get your kid to be so darn good, you know, because I want to take parenting lessons from them. But, like, whenever you – I remember one of the most cathartic things that I ever did was – and I loved, and I've been missed this last 2 years, is going down to team camp. And when all the kids go, you know, off to their dorms or whatever, the coaches just sit and talk, and they share parent stories and all these kind of things, parent horror stories. And it's just so cathartic. And I remember there was a many-year stretch where, you know, all these, you know, coaches would say all the horror stories they're having to deal with various parents. And I didn't have any of those issues. And so I got a little cocky, you know, a little hubris, like, oh, I've got this all figured out, you know. And right then is when you're going to get that one parent that just comes in, and it doesn't matter. There is no, you know, there's no defense against it, you know, type of thing. And it's just, I the one thing I try to kind of think about is parenting's hard, you know. I mean, coaching's hard, but parenting's really hard. The worst thing I do is parents. You know, I've got one 8-year-old, just turned 8, you know, on Sunday, 8-year-old boy. And it's like, you know, like teaching wise, coaching wise, I'm pretty good at those things, because this is like my 20th class I've had come through, let's say, coaching wise. And so all the same age, you know, basically everybody ultimately kind of has the same needs and stuff. There's a few different, you know, kind of personality types and so forth. But you have experience with it. You know how things go. You know how to problem solve through things after 20 years. This is my first 8-year-old I've ever had. I don't know what an 8-year-old boy is supposed to do. Next year will be the first 9-year-old I've ever had. And so, you know, anytime you do something for the first time, second time, third time, you're kind of bad at it, you know. And like, so everybody's just trying their best, you know. And so, you know, the parents are trying their best. But when you start combining, you know, sports, playing time, it's their daughter, they start seeing red a little bit, you know, if things aren't going the right way, and usually playing time issues and all those kind of things. Yeah, it can get, you know, it can get a little wacky. For the most part, it's been good. That in terms of advice, I would say, what I've done lately, so what I did, and it was successful for a number of years, was I just kind of stayed away from the parents. But I think I've turned a 180 on that, because since coming to Tualatin, I just been like best friends with the parents. Like I'm actually like I'm going to a concert with my best player's parents this weekend. You know, I've been to Jenny already. I mean, we just hang out. I hang out with a lot of the parents, and that was kind of more when I got to 12, and this was a great parent group, and they just kind of you said, hey, come over, let's hang out. You know, let's go to a concert, right. Let's do this, and so you know. But that's been really great. But that's the thing. As soon as I say, hey, you know what? Go be really friendly with all the parents and hang out with them. You know, that's when you get too cocky. You know,
right.
There's always going to be somebody that I know the next one that's going to be a problem is hanging around somewhere in the eighth grade or something. You know what I mean? Like they're lurking there waiting.
They're lurking.
So here's what I would say if I was talking about like advice. It was just have your players know you care about them. And if your players know that you truly care about them, that's going to solve 99% of the parent problems. Because if the kid really knows you care, it's really hard for mom or dad to plow through that. And you know, it only works 99% of the time. You know, I have that situation where it's like the kid loves playing for me and feels it's a great experience and the mom is still like, I don't care, you know, like, I don't care what my daughter says, you know, like, but I think if you have that really strong relationship with the kid and the kid knows that you're doing best by them, that will ameliorate, you know, a lot of the potential problems with parents.
Yeah. I'm curious with your sub-varsity coaches, right? One of our jobs is a head coach mm-hmm. of the program, hiring staff, and do you have those, your freshman JV coach, do you have them deal with their own parent issues, or do those parent issues come to you? How does that work?
Any minor stuff they would handle. You know, the buck's got to stop, I think, with the head coach. You know, ultimately, it's got to be them. A lot of what I've done this year is I just had, like, my two JV coaches, JV head and assistant, were mm-hmm. just former players of mine. You know, then you mm-hmm. that's an ultimate, you know, that's the greatest, you know, when you just get former players to be coaches for you, because you know, the loyalty and all those things which are so important, and it's just such a great thing to kind of, you know, bring those kids back in to the fold. But at the same time, you know, some of those are young. I don't really want to put them out there, you know, if there's going to be major issues. So yeah, I protect them. You know, I protect them to a certain degree. If anything were to be really bad, it is, you gotta go through me.
For sure. Yeah. All right. Good stuff, Coach. We're going to take a quick break. We'll return with more from Coach Pappas right after this on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Coaches, as you prepare for the upcoming season, don't forget to renew your OBCA membership. Membership includes access to exclusive resources from high school coaches across the country, as well as access to Lucio Sports Technology, the same technology used by NBA franchises. Membership starts at just $15. Don't delay. Renew your OBCA membership today.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Derek Duman here with Coach Wes Pappas. Coach, I want to talk about some more X's and O's practice type things in our next segment here. So if I were to come watch a Tualatin girls basketball practice, you invited me, I showed up, what would I see? What would I hear? What would I feel? What would it look like?
Love it. So we practice really hard. I think that's something that you would see. Constantly putting players into very difficult to deal with situations. Very physical, not always pretty. You know, there's kind of ways to run practice where everything looks kind of really cool, cones and, you know, whatever. And everybody has like kind of a lot of success in it. I just kind of, we just go straight from like tough with the ball drill, which is just elbows out and just brutal, to 3-on-4 to half court with rules, to then double the ball drill. And it's just like super physical, super oriented to make the kids have to make really difficult decisions and stuff that they are going to ultimately fail at many times before they start to succeed. And I just, you know, I believe in making practice, you know, way tougher than a game. So you shrink the court, you put more defenders on, you do everything you can to make it just way more difficult in terms of the amount of pressure, let's say, that the defense can put on the offense type of stuff. I do talk a lot more, I think, than you're supposed to. You know, I know what it's supposed to be. I think people make the air the wrong way. I think that everything's a spectrum. I think, you know, this is just my personal opinion, but like, I've seen errors, you know, the other way, where it's supposed to go like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, everything's on the clock, you move from drill to drill, no talking, blah, blah, blah. And I've just seen like that go on and on, because I watch a lot of practices, I try to watch people's practices, and I go, ooh, you just did 5 minutes, I don't think your kids know why, or what they were doing, or are they any better at it after that 5 minute session at it, you know, it's like, I really believe in the why, you know, and explaining to kids and actually doing a drill until you see adequate level of improvement to build on for the next day from said drill. So if that means that I said 5 minutes for that drill, but it ends up going 11 and a half minutes, then it just goes 11 and a half minutes. And so I like that kind of level of flexibility. I don't like too tight a practice schedule. And a lot of explaining, you know, why, I think that's been really beneficial to us. You know, that it's just, you know, everybody, yeah, that's a beautiful thing about it. There's so many different ways to go about it, and people do it a lot of different ways and are successful different ways.
So. Yeah. I'm curious, you know, teaching physicality is a skill, right? You talk about being physical, the drills you're doing. And I think sometimes it can be maybe more difficult on the girl side. Chris, what do you think it is? Is it just the drills? Is it the situations? What do you think has helped build that physicality in your team?
Well, yeah, it's really kind of, okay, so, you know, very few kids come in physical. From like youth ball, like at all, like, you know, they like a lot, like, I think the default would be like avoiding, you know, physicality and all that. One, and this, I learned this really early on, is the girls game is immensely physical. You know, it just is. There's a lot of collisions. It's just a really physical sport. At times, I think more physical, you know, given, you know, adjusting for body mass and stuff, you know, within the guys game, because guys, a lot of it's in the air and avoiding contact, and you can kind of, you know, change in the air and change angles. And it's not just, the girls game is a lot of collisions, you know, because everybody's kind of playing at ground level for the most part. So it's an extremely physical game. And girls, you know, I just learned this like really early on, they can just get after it. You know, there's not, you know, this, it, you just, like, you just, I read this, like, the first year I was coaching girls, I read this book, and I only got one thing out of the book, but it was one of the most important things, and it just said, you know, girls will run through a wall for you, they will play every bit as hard, if not harder than guys, they just have to know you care about them. And so, I start with that mentality of, these girls will just be physical. There's not going to be any way, you know, kind of around that. And then it's just kind of slowly but surely applauding physical play. So you start out with drills, and at first, you know, you got the ones that kind of cower away from that because they're not used to it. And then you just really celebrate physicality. If I have a kid that like even runs in and just bowls somebody over, eventually we get them to that point, and, you know, it's like an offensive foul. No problem with that. You know, I just like, it's just like, totally. Yes. Good. You know, like, that's fine. You know, don't ever look over and, like, you know, if you commit an offensive foul because you went in too hard, you know, and rolled over somebody, I will never be mad, you know, because it's just kind of moving them in that direction, and they get used to it, and then they start to enjoy it, and, you know, it's I don't know. I love that kind of scaffolding and getting them from maybe not being physical to being hyper-physical. I think it's one of my favorite parts of the game.
For sure. And to a previous point you made, just with building confidence, right? You know, usually when they're willing to play physically, they have the confidence in that they know what they're doing, and they're going to do that at full speed.
Yeah.
And then whatever happens. So,
exactly.
All right, Coach, time to talk about the zone. You're a Big Zone guy. I think a lot of people probably know that. You mentioned you started as a man guy, and then kind of switched over. So talk to me about the zone. What do you love so much about the zone, and why has that kind of taken over as your primary defensive philosophy?
I just love zone. It's been like, so I started out man. That's all I knew. That's the first, what was it? Like 7 years I coached, I think, was all man to man. That's what I knew. You know, that's all I played. That's what Evers coached. That's what Naylor coached. Two really good man to man coaches. And I remember in the early 2000s, I was watching the Big East tourney, you know, back when Syracuse had a great Big East stuff and Syracuse was in there. I was watching the Big East tourney one time and I was just watching how Syracuse moved. You know, and obviously everybody knows a 2-3 zone, like a typical 2-3 zone, but specifically how they were moving in it. And I just was like, for some reason, just glommed onto it. And I kind of had this like epiphany. I just went like, I've been coaching girls basketball for a while and I went like, oh, like, I just think this would just be amazing, you know? And mm-hmm. I started to kind of, like, kind of ingest anything I could associated with it. So I, you know, a lot of those kind of championship production clinics and, you know, all those kind of mm-hmm. things. And I started getting, like, you know, watching zone. One of the ones I watched was, like, Wayne Morgan, which is, like, coached Iowa State for, like, a second. And I would get like a little bit from each, and then I kind of created this like Frankenstein monster, which is like something that's truly mine. You know, I didn't get this zone mm-hmm. from anybody. It's just kind of little pieces from a lot of different sources that I put together, and then I just created my own parts to make it work. And I remember going to Naylor and said, at Century, and I said, hey, I know what will just change everything for us. I think this will be the most dominant defense, you know, in the state for girls basketball. And he goes, well, what is it? And I go, well, 2-3 zone, but it's, and he goes, that won't work. He goes, it won't work. It was too good of shooters in the Metro League, you know, we're the Metro League at the time. And it just won't work. And so that kind of went on. I went, okay, fine. And I kept bugging him about it, and we went to Tigard, and then we were there for 3 years at Tigard, and we were man-to-man and would play, like, you know, 2% zone, and we got bumped out of the play. Every year we'd have about 20 wins, but then we'd get bumped out of the playoffs before we got to the quarterfinals every year, and then year four, he finally just said, okay, you have the defense 100% and just go zone 100% of the time. So we went from, like, 98% man to 100% zone with me just doing it all. And then we just started making the, you know, quarterfinals every year. I think we made like 4 years in a row. And it just started immediately. And so I've run the zone now for 12 years, the last four at Tigard, then over to Sherwood for 6, and Tualatin for 2. So 12 years, 3 different teams. And over that 12-year span, we've given up the fewest points in the state 10 of those 12 years. I don't think that ever will be done again. Because talent adjusted. You have to, like, understand it. There was a middle gap in there where we weren't very good, you know? Like, and so there's only been 2 years out of the last 12 that my team didn't give up the fewest points in the state. That was the first year that Sherwood went to 6A, and we just were not ready for that level. Mm-hmm. And we just gave up like third fewest in the state. And then my first year at Tualatin, where the kids were all just new to it, you know, we were good. We were top 8 in the, you know, we finished 8th in my OSA rankings, but we just, you know, didn't finish, you know, dead last or dead, you know, first and fewest points given up. And then this year we did it again. And some people go, well, yeah, but they played slower. No, we were one of the highest scoring teams in the state this year. You know, our margin of victory was about 30, you know, in league play this year. And 5 of those teams went to the quarterfinals. 3 at Tigard, 1 at Sherwood, 1 at Tualatin this year. And so, you know, it's just been, it's been really successful for us. You know, I think you got to have a lot more talent than us to be able to really score on us. You know, obviously, you know, mm-hmm. if the talent, you know, if the talent differential gets massive, then yes, then, you know, it's not, there's no foolproof for that. But if it's going to be in the ballpark in terms of talent, you will struggle. Everybody has. It's been 12 years. It hasn't gotten mm-hmm. better, you know, in terms of, right. you know, opponents, you know, kind of thing. And like I said, we just came off giving up the fewest in the state this year again.
Yeah. So I'm curious to, you know, you're 100% zone, and I'm sure you play some teams that play zone, but also, so, you know, how do you kind of split that time, right? Because your girls have to play man in order to prepare, I would assume, for an upcoming game, but that's not what you're going to primarily run. So kind of how do you, like, split that time in order to make sure that they are successful against a man team versus playing zone all the time?
Yeah, yeah. And just want to say that we have gone to running a 1-3-1, you know, maybe about 20% of the time. So we run a 1-3-1 too. That one's just kind of, you know, I copied from other people, you know, type of thing. But we have gone to that too because we just need something when teams pull that ball out against us, you know, and that, so we've got a really aggressive pick up at 3/4 court 1-3-1 that we'll do. But in terms of the man teams, and don't get me wrong, I appreciate really, really good man-to-man defense too. I just know that, you know, I've done this thing where I can be the best at 2-3 zone. If we went man, I would coach my butt off in man, but I would not, I mean, there's some guys that are really good or some coaches that are really good at man-to-man defense. One of them in your league that on the girls side, Cal Wald, is phenomenal. I mean, you know, so we just, you know, it's just one of those things. I don't think I can be as good as him in man-to-man, you know, so it's like, let's go with what we can be good at. But in terms of man, oh yeah, most of our practice is man-to-man, right? I mean, cause that's what most teams are going to run against us. And so, you know, obviously we're playing man-to-man defense. We go to team camp. We love the man-to-man defense sessions where we're, you know, we're on defense actually and running against that. So, you know, obviously a lot of man-to-man. The biggest problem is actually us in terms of zone. We have a hard time running our zone offense against our zone. Just because, you know, so that actually – we actually have to dummy up our zone to make our zone offense sometimes work. And so that's kind of always been like a little bit of a problem. And also, you know, man-to-man takes a lot of time and effort, you know, so does zone. If you're going to be really good at it, but you know, man-to-man takes a ton of time and effort. And so I think one of the problems is that because we're not a great man-to-man team, you know, but our offense isn't maybe necessarily going against the best, you know, in practice sometimes. But you know, everybody just has the reverse problem with us and their defense. They try to play, hey, we're going to play, you know, Fulton. We got to put in a 2-3 zone. You know, it's like,
right, exactly.
Good luck. You know. So.
For sure. Yeah, and you know, I want to hopefully have you dive in just a little bit. You don't have to, you know, tell us all the patented secrets that you've got behind the zone. But I'm curious, you know, in your 2-3 zone, maybe what are a couple of key things that you teach the top of the zone and what are maybe some of the key points that you talk to the bottom of your zone about?
Well, everything is broken down really hyper-specifically. So I created footwork for things that I like just on my own, for things that I wanted to see happen that I didn't actually see any teams ever do. And so, like, for example, the ability to, if the ball's passed from the top to a wing, let's say at the 45-degree, you know, like angle, and then immediately down to the corner, it was really important in my kind of vision of what needed to happen that would always be taken by an outside bottom kid. And you cannot have your top kids get there first to a wing shooter, because then you're kind of guarding two with three, you know, type of thing, or you're guarding three with two. And so we needed to get our outside bottom to be able to hit that wing and stop the shot and then be there the same time the ball gets there and the same time to the corner. And there's only one way that can happen. You have to hit your feet perfectly. So there's a specific footwork, you know, if the ball's going to get passed really quick through there, well, you can be same time to the wing, same time to the corner, same time as ball, you know, on both. And so if you have to flip your hips, you have to hit with, like, let's say on your, if you're the offense, we're looking at the direction the offense is facing, and you're on the right hand side, you know, based on the offense, you know, what direction they're facing, you have to hit with your right foot, and your left foot has to hit a certain spot going to that corner, you know, and you have to cover ground there. You cannot waste a step, and the strides have to be a certain length, because we've figured this out. We've just timed it out, stopwatches and reps, and there's just no possible way that you can do it if you don't use a very specific footwork. And so, it's just, you know, very specific on that. That's one thing that happens almost every practice or every other practice is going to be me going down. I've done this for 12 years, me going down and just isolating an outside bottom side, having one kid there, having them guard three or four kids, you know, like three, maybe half at a time. Like, so have them guard a wing, have them guard a corner, have them guard a block, and have them go through the progressions of what if wing catches and drives? What if wing catches and immediately passes? What if wing catches, shot fakes, and then passes the corner? What if the wing passes the corner and then immediately into the post, which we double always? And just getting all those steps perfect, you know, kind of thing. And I'm really picky, you know what I mean? Like, but the girls like it. They really do, because they feel great success, and it's fun to play. It takes a lot of the ambiguity out of the game. Defense has so much ambiguity, right? Man-to-man defense is just a battle in ambiguity. You know, it's like, well, should I help on that one or not? Well, maybe he helped a little too much. He didn't recover quite, you know, like, should I, you know, it's just, there's a lot of different scenarios. Zone, we've got to the point where there's just really not. We know if a player's been coached for two or three years, they would know everything. You know, like there would be no situation that would ever surprise them. They know where to be on everything.
Yeah. I like
top of zone is just an absolute fight. Top of zone drills, I mean, it's so fun. We start at half court. You've got to pinch the middle hard. You've got to cover so many things. You've got to read, you know, the shooter. Is that person putting that ball into a shooting pocket? You got the high post. You got to go into the high side. We start the high side of the wing. You try not to let it reverse. You've got it. And it's just, I mean, we ask our top kids to do so much. And then fighting through screens. I mean, we have a very specific way to deal with ball screens, and we just drill it and drill it and drill it. And everything that you could possibly do against us, we just drill, drill, drill. So it's just not a surprise. You know, our girls know what to do.
Right. Have you seen, I think, you know, especially on the guy side, but I think on the girl side as well, you know, like Steph Curry effect, right? Kids are starting to pull up now from, you know, 6 feet beyond the 3-point line. And a lot of times in the zone, right, one of the things that traditionally can be successful is teams that shoot it really well.
Mm-hmm.
What adjustments do you make to teams that have some knockdown shooters?
Well, we feel that we really are ultimately four out. So that, we do not run zone to stop the ball from going inside. That's not what we're doing. That's maybe a typical thing that you would do. You feel that you can't guard, you know, let's say a post or something, so you kind of pack it in. We're not packed in. We have one kid in the middle. That helps if that kid is like Natalie Lathrop, which we had for the last couple of years in 6'3". this year, I think we'll be running about 5'10 in the middle, so it's not going to be the same effect. But we really feel that we're four out. So if you have four shooters, we feel that we can guard that. We will just be all the way out. I mean, if you want to go four out, then we'll just match up with you perfectly, chase you off the 3-point line all night. I mean, if you have five shooters, technically that would be a thing. But if you have five shooters, then your spacing is not going to be very good. We feel that we can guard that too. Because we're very good at stopping shot and being on to the next thing in one motion. And we use that. Right. We use that a lot. You know, so if you've got five out, then you know that can be guarded too. So we don't feel we go. You know, there's no point where we go, oh, they've got four shooters that are lights out. That's going to be the problem. No, that's not a problem at all. Now, if you have four shooters that are lights out, and you've got a post that will just murder our post, you know, like our middle of our zone,
right?
Yeah, that's a problem, but we're not winning anyway. You know what I mean? Because if you have four lights out shooters and a post that will just dominate down low, then you're just better. I mean, that's not, that, there's nothing that can be done against you, against anybody. So, you know, that's the way. Now, in terms of the deeper three, yeah, we've guarded kids out deeper than pro. I mean, we had a kid, you know, at Newberg that used to shoot from the Newberg logo, Taylor Rarick, who was just a stud. And, you know, we played against those kids that will, you know, shoot the ball from further out, you know, and in pro range or maybe even a little bit further sometimes. And if they've got one of those, that's not really a problem. We can extend that out. You know, you hope that they don't have that plus the dominant pose plus the four other, you know, I mean, but like I said, there just comes a point when there's nothing you could do anyway. So yeah, no, we can extend it out. We don't feel that, you know, we would like to guard the 3-point line and maybe, you know, a step or so back. But if we scout you out that you have a kid that can shoot, you know, from pro range, then that adjustment can be made and it has been made. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're seeing that more and more, or is that something?
You know, I mean, I think kids are maybe stepping back more and more, you know, stats matter. Mm-hmm. Like, if they are stepping back, doesn't mean that's going to beat you. You know, I think, you know, people will, if you hit like 3 pro 3s in a girls basketball game, that's, you know, the crowd's really going to like that a lot. It really matters how many shots that took for you to make those three, you know? And so you hit 3 pros. I mean, okay, that's 9 points. You're not going to win that way. I mean, we beat teams that have hit, I mean, you know, like, gosh, sometimes we beat a Jamie Merritt team at Westview when we were at Tigard, and they hit 9 threes. And we hit none. And so it was 27-0 off of threes, but we went to the free throw line all night. And we won the game. And that was, you know, there's been some others like that too, where it's like, so you hit 3 pro 3s and then you got, so that's 9 points. Like that, it's a much bigger deal, I think, to the crowd or to the interpretation of people than actually what wins and loses games.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the deep shooting.
Right, for sure.
It looks a lot cooler than it actually counts. Now, maybe if they had that Mountain Dew, you know, 4-point shot or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
right?
That would be
different.
But, yeah, that's different. We'd have to shot.
Yeah. I tell kids that, too. You know, when someone crosses somebody's ankles and the whole gym's like, oh, but then they missed the shot. I'm like, well, then that wasn't that cool. You know what I mean? Like, it would be really cool if you make the shot. We should hold the O until the shot goes in. Then you can go nuts and everybody can freak out. But
that's so true. That's so true. That right? Big O goes before we ever saw it happen.
And then you miss it, we get a rebound, and we go score on the other end. You know, so it's like, hey, I guess it really didn't matter that much, right?
That's funny.
All right, we're gonna take another quick break. When we return, Coach Pappas will try to beat the shot clock here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Coaches, save the date. The 2021 OACA OBCA Nike Basketball Coach of the Year Clinic will be held Friday, October 8th at Liberty High School. Also, plan to join us for the second annual OBCA Golf Tournament Saturday, October 9th at the OGA Golf Course in Woodburn. You can find more information at or.nhsbca.org.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. We're talking with Wes Pappas, the girls' basketball coach at Tualatin High School. Coach, for my next set of questions, I'm going to put you up against the shot clock. So I'm going to put 35 seconds on a timer, and I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions that should have 1 or 2-word answers. And
oh,
we're
going
to see how many – yeah. And we're going to see how many of those questions you can get done.
Gotcha.
Sound good?
So, yeah.
Nothing too hard, hopefully. Putting you on the spot a little bit, though, right? Clock will be going. So, and we'll go from there. So, 35 seconds on the timer, starting now. Do you think Oregon high school basketball should have a shot clock?
Yes, I would support that.
If you're up 3 points with less than 10 seconds, do you foul?
Yes.
Favorite way to guard on-ball screens?
It depends where they are. We try to get over unless they're too deep for a pullback.
What's your favorite sports movie?
Hoosiers.
How do you celebrate after a big win?
Out to dinner with the team.
What's one word officials would use to describe you?
I think I'm reasonable.
Reasonable. Good. That's good. Time. That's it. Good work, coach. There you go. Not too bad, right? Not too
bad.
Yeah, I like it. Good stuff. You know, we call it the shot clock segment, rapid fire. I think it's kind of a fun way to see how other coaches think with, you know, down three, less than 10 seconds, et cetera. But I do want to kind of follow up on your shot clock answer a little bit. Obviously, Oregon doesn't currently have a shot clock, but recently NFHS has said states will have a choice if they would like to implement one. You mentioned you were in favor. Can you explain why?
Well, okay. So the answer, the longer answer is, I think it's a good idea. I don't think it's as big maybe a deal as some coaches. I don't love the artificial part of it. You know, I don't like moving into fences in baseball. I don't like the you can't touch the quarterback or receiver, so we just get more points. I don't like making the goal bigger in hockey. There is a kind of an artificial element to it, and I think it doesn't correctly diagnose the major problem, which is the inequality that exists with too many people gaming the system and getting kids the choice into this school when they enter high school or transfers. And, you know, there's too much inequality, and I think it exacerbates that a little bit. With that said, I think it definitely helps us. From a selfish standpoint, I think it helps us.
Right.
Because we've played in Washington, we've played in California, and it is much more difficult for teams to play up against that shot clock against us than what we've had, you know, in terms of us scoring against the shot clock. It's not really been a factor offensively for us. Defensively, we've pushed a lot of teams up against that shot clock. But I think it's just kind of, we're there. That's where we are. You know, we've got, you know, the high school game or the college game, that's where, you know, some of our kids are headed. We kind of want to prepare them for that. You know, the modern game is a faster game. And I also think, see, I'm speaking from the girl standpoint where stalling is not a, you know, we've been accused of stalling. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes that's the best thing you can do if you don't have as much talent. But the problem is that stalling is not a real big factor in the girls' game, just because, you know, if you don't have as much talent, you're trying to win by that. You have to work really hard. I mean, it's hard not to turn the ball over. You know, with guys' game, I think it's just time. You know, you got to do the same for both sports. It's time. I mean, because the guys' game, you really can have these kind of long, drawn out possessions, and stalling can be implemented, I think, a lot easier. I think, you know, from the guy standpoint, especially the girl standpoint, yes, but to a lesser degree, I think it will help the game, to put in the shot clock.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's not as strong as the answer, you know?
Right. No, I get it. I hear you. Yeah. I think, you know, your strike is good, and if, you know, there's still coaches that don't want it. You know, and I think they bring up some really good points as well, you know. But I tend to be more where you're at, is, you know, like that the game's moving there. You know, I mean, FIBA rules, they're playing with a 24-second shot clock in middle school, you know. So, like, obviously it can be done, right? We're just choosing not to. So it's one of those things of
– at a certain point, you look like – at a certain point, you look like the old fuddy duddies, you know, kind of thing.
Because
when the direction's moving that way, you know, anyway. And like I said, I think it's, I don't know. What do you think? I mean, a guy's game, I mean, is stalling, I mean, you know, and having these really long, drawn out possessions in the quarters and things, is that something that happens a lot?
I don't know if I'd say it a lot, but it happens. You know, I think I think it most games won't be impacted too much by the shot clock. Because just teams shoot the ball before then. You know what I mean? Like the ball's up before 35 seconds. I do think it will make a difference at the end of game, the end of quarter, end of half situations, right? You know, I coached a game against a good friend of mine who he saw the last 2 minutes of regulation because it was a tie game. So he waited for the last shot.
Yeah.
They missed, so we went to overtime. And then he did the same thing in overtime. You know, we missed a free throw to go up by one. He held the ball the last 2 minutes, and they hit a shot at the buzzer to beat us. You know, and it's one of those things where it's like, that's obviously within the rules, so they deserve to win the game. But at the same time, you know, it's like, hey, man, like, there's some cool strategy stuff that can happen in that time. You know, you're like, hey, can we do 2-for-1 here? You know what I mean? Like, hey, kids will buy into defense. You know, hey, guys, you don't have to defend for 35 seconds. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's some things that I think would make the game just a little bit more exciting, especially in those situations. Because if you're down six, you don't feel like it's over. Right? Like, right now, you're down six. You're like, shoot, we got a foul with 3 minutes because we're never going to get the ball.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, no, I get you. Yeah, no, 100%. I really enjoyed going, you know, playing in Washington, playing in California, went to Florida for a tourney. Like, I can't remember if Florida had it or not, but actually, you know, Washington, California definitely did. And I remember, you know, like with 4 minutes to go and you're down a certain amount of points or 3 minutes to go, you know, it was like, okay, we got to get out of the zone, you know, in Oregon because they're just going to hold the ball, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
And there you go. No, there's going to be enough possessions in this game still, you know.
Right.
Type of thing. And you start doing the math and it's the direction things are going. How many states have it? Do you know?
I think it's up to 10 now, if I'm not mistaken.
Only 10 have a shot clock?
Not until recently did NFHS make it possible, right? So it was illegal based on NFHS. So what would happen is the states would no longer be voting members.
If
they defied the rules. Yeah, yeah. So like OSAA, and rightfully so, didn't want to go against NFHS. So they kept with it, right? And some of the other states were like, well, we don't really care, so we're just going to do it.
Washington's had it for like 20 years.
I know.
Like first or second year, we were playing with like a 30-second shot clock, that's it.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of funny how that, you know, how that all works. But, it'll be interesting to see. I'm curious to see, you know, this next year or two, what Oregon looks to do. And, you know, coaches listening, I'm sure you'll receive a survey from two, either from us at the OBCA or from the OSAA, probably asking for thoughts. So.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see here. Coach, what's the strangest thing that you've ever seen in a basketball gym?
It's mostly on the club and youth side because there's just less oversight in those gyms. High school's actually the most, you know, you've got an AD, you got administration, there's repercussions. But, I think anybody who's been to a lot of youth and a lot of club games, I've seen parents throwing down. I've seen dads throwing down. I've seen moms throwing down. I mean, it's like, honestly, like, you know, one of these Southwest or Spirit Airlines flights, you know, some of these, you know, youth ball games.
Right.
I mean, there's people throwing haymakers in the stands. And it's just sad. That is strange. It's strange, but it happens far too often. Fortunately, not so much at the high school games.
Yes. Yeah. No kidding. How do you go about selecting your team captain? What's that process look like?
Players choose always. I don't even vote myself. I let the players choose. So far, so good on that. You know, I think more buy-in, you know, because they choose. I guess they could choose incorrectly. that hasn't happened so far. We'll see. Players have chosen. And you know, there's just those tough years. There's a lot of years where I would have chosen the same people, the players do. also those, some of those years where you're like, I'm really glad I don't have to choose because this would be really hard to kind of cut it off here. This one in, that one out, you know, like, and so, I put it up to an anonymous vote.
Perfect. How do you have two or three, or is it just dependent on how many?
Two or three. You know, I think more than three is too many. Two's about right, but I tend to try to have the continuity one where you've got, you know, I'll go two if you've got like one senior, one junior. And so you can have the continuity the next year with having one returning captain kind of thing. If it's kind of like two seniors and then the third would be a junior, you know, we'll go with that. I kind of do where the natural break would be, but yeah. So like this year, for example, was kind of a rough one because we just had just so many good seniors that they chose three seniors. They chose three juniors the year before. So it's fine. So we had the continuity. Then they, you know, chose the same group, coming back. And so we had three seniors. So we have, this is the first year I think that we have no returning captain. I've never had that to happen, but there's just no way around that. Our seniors needed to be captain. Matter of fact, four of them needed to be captains. One of them actually got left out that totally needed to be a captain, but I wasn't going to go with four. So we'll be choosing from scratch, I think, for the first time this season. But yeah, the continuity, I try to get to, unless it's two seniors, in which case the third one, if it's a junior, would work out nice, or a sophomore or something, you know?
Yeah. Do you give your captains any roles or responsibilities?
Yeah, they do a lot. We have them kind of, you know, organize kind of the team dinner type of stuff that they do. They play a huge role in kind of, you know, organizing kind of any of the kind of bonding events and things like that. I really, you know, by the time you're a senior in high school, let's say you're a senior captain, you know, girls basketball a little bit different because girls are, you know, oftentimes kind of full grown by the time they're a senior, by the time they're a freshman, excuse me. So when, you know, they come into high school, you get a lot more of that kind of straight to varsity thing. So by the time they're a junior or senior captain, they've been on varsity 3 or 4 years oftentimes, which is not, you know, always the case with guys. And so you're really in a position where you know that kid really well. So, you know, I just kind of rely on them, you know, a lot of the kind of updates, how the team is going. I will put them in charge of like, okay, you know, this kid's feeling a little left out, make sure that changes. And once a kid's on varsity for 3 or 4 years, you just have this, you know, trust, and you just know them so well. It's one of the most rewarding things, I think, is just having, you know, especially those kind of straight to varsity or quickly to varsity kids, and now they're seniors, and you know, it's like they're part of the family after 4 years, you know, type of thing. And you really can really trust them to kind of delegate a lot of things to them. And you know, I've had some kids just do amazing things with benefiting team chemistry and making sure everybody's included and organizing things, so forth.
Yeah. So what's your favorite team bonding activity?
Going out to eat is our big thing. We love to go out to eat on the program always, you know, just spending, get that credit card going. I love it though. You know, there's something about just being taken out, you know, to dinner. But the big thing with me, it honestly is, and it's the same thing when I was like, you know, in high school, I loved it when the coaches were away, you know, like, so we might have a barbecue in the back. We might go out to dinner. But I let the kids do their thing, especially at team camp type of thing. Like after we finish at team camp and the girls, you know, go back to their dorm, I always like mandate that they just party, you know, and go even past curfew, you know, like I'm like, I don't care what you guys are doing. Just make sure everybody's doing it and have fun. And you guys party it up. Just be ready to go on the court at 7:30 tomorrow morning, you know, and, you know, curfew, whatever, because that, I don't know. I always think that, you know, as a kid, my favorite times, the times when I got to know people the best, teammates and so forth, was not when like a coach was leading like a, hey, you've got to get across the gym using only a towel and fork, you know, it, like the structured things. It was always like coach is now over there, and it's just we are put into a place together. And, you know, that part may be forced, like a team camp or a dinner or something like that, but it's not like some kind of structured activity. It's just we're kind of, in essence, put into this place together. And then I just kind of look from afar, check in every once in a while, and I see that, you know, they're doing their thing. And I love that. I don't know. I don't think there's anything better than that, you know, personally. It's just a lot of unstructured time where they are structured to be together. And then make sure your team captains have this trust thing that make sure, hey, make sure everybody's included, you know, kind of thing.
Right. Exactly. What's your favorite drill?
Oh, love drills. I'm going to go, I could go any of a couple. 3-on-4 to half court, I love. Double the ball drill. Some kind of those, let's shrink the area, put extra defenders on you, you know, confine how many dribbles you can get. You've got to be super tough with the ball. You've got to do all that. And then my, you know, kind of the old favorite, that's just the old school one that everybody does, but I just love, is zigzag. You know, one person's on offense, one person on defense. Can you get that ball to half court? Small area, shrink down the court, you know, type of thing. And then it's just like, get your head in front of the ball, and somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. I love somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of competitiveness. Sometimes, you know, when it gets to that final round, I go, okay, every stop what you're doing, we're going to watch this kid versus that kid. You know, somebody, if they don't get the tip, if they don't tip this ball, defense loses. If this person gets, you know, their ball tipped, offense loses. All right, let's just see who's better right now. You know, and everybody wants.
Right.
I love that stuff and getting them to compete. And the more you do it, the more they just, that's just the way it is for them. And they start to really get after it. And you get those kids that are like, they're friends, but they're just really getting after each other. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I like it. Well, Coach, I think that's all I have for you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. You're doing a great thing, you know, adding more, you know, voices out there and more exposure for high school basketball. Hey, I love it, really appreciate you having me.
If you have any follow-up questions or you want to get a hold of Coach Pappas, we'll put his contact information in the episode description. We hope you'll join us next time here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Until then, coach them up.
Thank you for listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Is there a coach you'd like to hear from or a topic you'd like to hear us discuss? You can write us a message on the Anchor website or send us an email at OregonBasketballCoaches@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify.